This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash, A Dream Deferred, the economy of race and class inequality. We're joined now by Valerie Wilson, director of the Economic Policy Institute's program on race, ethnicity, and the economy. Prior to joining EPI, Valerie was the vice president of research at the National Urban League's Washington Bureau. She's written extensively on issues of wealth disparities and access to higher education, and was selected to deliver the keynote address at an event on minority economic empowerment at the Nobel Peace Center. And along with Valerie Wilson is Manuel Pastor, professor of geography and American studies and ethnicity at the University of Southern California.
He's also the founding director of the Center for Justice, Tolerance, and Community at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and is co-director of USC's Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration. He's co-authored Uncommon Common Ground, Race and America's Future, and authored This Could Be the Start of Something Big, How Social Movements for Regional Equity Are Transforming Metropolitan America.
Welcome. There's big debate now about Mr. Piketty. What he is suggesting is driving the inequality of income and wealth is that we are dominated by an oligarchy, that wealth has little to do with the actual creation of real wealth from the working class. Both of you, how you understand the dilemma that we face at this juncture in capital?
Mr. Piketty's work shifts the conversation from talking about what those in the middle and lower end of the income distribution aren't doing to what's really happening at the top of the income distribution. He analyzed data from about 20 countries as far back as the 18th century. Historically, times when we've seen growing economic inequality have been times when the returns on capital have been greater than the rate of economic growth. So we've returned to that trend. The time when it was interrupted a bit was by the two world wars and the Depression. And we saw greater shared prosperity as a result of economic growth increasing more than the rate of returns to capital. But since then, capital has always been highly concentrated among the wealthiest. So when the returns to capital are exceeding the rate of economic growth, that's when we see this growing income inequality. And I think the way that he has described it is a way that many people knew of it or understood it, but putting the numbers and the data behind it is really powerful in helping to change the conversation.
Manuel, if you would follow up on that in terms of where we are now and why things so dire at this point.
There's three big and important things to take away from his work and some other work that's emerging now. One is that he points to the fact that the period between 1945 and the mid-1970s, which was this golden era of economic growth in the United States, and it was one in which wages at the bottom end of the income distribution were rising as rapidly as wages at the top, was actually sort of a historical anomaly. We grew accustomed to thinking of that golden age of capitalism in both the United States and Europe as being the norm, and rising inequality as being the exception. He's really saying that that's a historic break, that period, and instead we've gone back to the long-term trajectory from the 18th and 19th centuries, as Valerie was saying. The second thing is he's returned us to political economy and being aware that this income distribution is not simply a mechanical process. It's influenced by political power and the ability to manipulate political systems in the favor of the rich, and it also helps to reinforce their political power because of the concentrated wealth. The third thing, which the book doesn't lift up, but is really emerging in all sorts of other literature at the same time, is the idea that this level of inequality is actually bad for economic growth. That when you've got this much wealth concentrated at the top, that you're not getting the investments in the sort of broad range of skills, human development, etc., and actually mass consumption that can move an economy forward into the future. So I think it's a really critical reexamination time for people looking at the U.S. and international economy. It's a really critical reexamination. This is really Das Kapital, Marx's volume, for the 21st century. And one of the things that Marx and Das Kapital said, predicted that there would be a falling rate of profit over the long term, and that would create a crisis of capitalism that would lead to a transformation. In some ways, what Piketty is saying is that, in fact, the data suggests that there's a rising rate of profit, and that that's really creating a crisis for democracy.
What he has shown in terms of the concentration of wealth and its relationship to capital, he's shown it over a much longer period of time, but it's consistent with a lot of the work that EPI has been doing since the 80s and tracking the fact that when we look at what has happened to the distribution of aggregate income, we've seen increasingly large shares of aggregate income going to those at the top, and particularly those in the top 1%, while the rest of people in this country have not seen the same level of income growth. And a large part of that has been related to the shift toward more capital-based income over labor income or wages. But even on the wages side, through the growth in CEO pay, through the fact that more CEOs and people in higher managerial positions are paid or are given stock options, and that's connected to the stock market, which we know during the current recovery has rebounded much more quickly than either wages or employment. And all of these things have contributed to this outpacing of income growth at the top, whereas the rest of Americans have seen much less income and wage growth.
Monroe, we did see that shift away from the post-war period, starting in the 70s and the 80s, but now there seems to be another shift in the post-recession period, which things are actually getting worse, both in terms of income growth and inequality. Can you talk about what's happening now?
One of the things that Piketty tells us is that in periods of low growth, the capital share of income tends to rise. And as a result of that, so does capital's political power and its ability then to reinforce its position within the society. So one of the things that's gone on with Great Recession is that while it should have shaken our faith in free market capitalism, after all, it was deregulation and inequality that played a role in triggering the crisis. Instead, Wall Street got off without very much punishment, in fact, with often quite a large bailout for the risky behaviors they engaged in. As a result, you've seen easily over 90% of the income gains coming out of the recession accruing to the top 1%, even as slow economic growth has reduced the bargaining power of average workers and certainly of low-income folks. This has actually been an unusual recession, too, in that a lot of the loss of income has come from joblessness and not simply wages falling over time. So it's been a huge cut for middle-class and working-class families, and that just has reinforced the political economy that got us into the mess in the first place.
10.5 million Americans are still looking for work. The unemployment rate is said to be 6.7%. And employers clearly feel no pressure to raise wages for those who are working. So what is the result of this on the average household's take-home pay?
The fact that we continue to have so many workers who are unemployed, and on top of that, nearly a third of those unemployed workers have been without work for 6 months or longer. So there's a huge number of what we call long-term unemployed people in the economy as well. So when you have labor markets where the demand for labor is less than the current supply of labor, then you tend to have that downward pressure on wages. So there's really no incentive for employers to pay higher wages because there are all these people who are out looking for jobs. We continue to have the number of openings being much smaller than the number of unemployed looking for work. That's something that continues to depress wages. Workers find that they have less bargaining power. But on top of that, there's been a general shift where we see that there has been an erosion in labor standards. We've seen a weakening of unions and a concerted attack against unions and against workers having the right to organize. All of these things together are presenting a challenge in terms of growing wages. And just most recently, we've begun to hear more about states that have decided to increase their minimum wage, although this continues to be a fight at the federal level. There are a number of things, in addition to the sluggish economy, there's been a general overall erosion of labor standards and of bargaining power for workers.
And Manuel, how does this growing inequality perpetuate the recession itself?
Starting about 20 years ago, people looking at economic growth in the developing world began to notice that those places that were more unequal were tending to grow more slowly over time. Places that were more unequal tended to invest less in basic public education. They also tended to get into a lot of conflicts over public policy, and particularly public policy around economic growth, what in the literature is called wars of attrition, where people sort of fight each other to death over economic policy rather than coming together on an economic growth strategy. Just last year, the International Monetary Fund did a study, take a look at what leads to growth lasting over time. Much to their surprise, they found out that the single most important factor at shortening growth sustainability was actually income inequality in the countries they took a look at. In the context of the United States, there's quite parallel findings. The metropolitan regions that are more unequal are generally growing more slowly, and they also tend to fall out of growth spells, not be as sustainable in terms of growth over time. When you've got a lot of inequality, less investment in public education, more tensions between groups, less ability to cohere on what the economic strategy ought to be going forward. And this really needs to be an important part of the way in which progressives change their economic message. We've often lifted up the issues of justice, fairness, and inclusion as essentially moral impulses or needs. But they're not just good for our morals and values. They're actually good for the economy. When people see a more equitable economy, they're going to tend to work harder because they think that it's actually going to pay off. They're going to have more money in their pockets, so that's going to lead to the demand side effects. And they're going to be more willing to either burden share or cohere on what an economic strategy is going forward. When we design an economy where all can win, then all pitch in to win.
The strongest employment growth during the sluggish recovery has been in low-wage work at places like strip malls and fast food restaurants. So where does this lead us at? And of course, we should say that there has been a tremendous kickstart and energy in the working class movement by virtue of the organizing that is going on in the fast food workers industry across the nation. So where does this leave us economically?
It has definitely been the case coming out of the recession that most of the growth has been in lower wage occupations, lower paying industries, whereas the majority of jobs that were lost over the course of the recession were in construction and manufacturing, which were typically higher paying occupations, but higher paying occupations that were accessible to people who perhaps didn't have to have a college education. We see the emergence of more low paying jobs, but I think we can't lose sight of the fact that job growth, period, has been well below what would be necessary to return us to pre-recession levels. And I think that that's going to present challenges moving forward because we've seen in the recovery since the 1980s that they have increasingly been labeled what they call jobless recoveries. And the recovery has taken longer and also has not been as significant in terms of replacing what was lost during the period of recovery. That has been really magnified in this current economic cycle. So that definitely presents challenges for those in the middle and the lower end of the income distribution who primarily get their income through wages and salary.
And the thing I would add to that is I think there's kind of two inequalities. There's more, because I'm going to put aside for a second racial and gender inequality, which I'm sure we're going to touch on. But in terms of the broad economic inequalities, there's two sorts in the United States. One is the inequality of the top 1%, which has a lot to do with inheritance, a CEO pay, jury rigging the tax system. And then the second is the kind of inequality that's broken out between those at the 90th percentile of the income distribution, those at the 10th, those in the middle and sort of below that. And a lot of that has to do with changing returns to skill, education, et cetera. And we have to have strategies to deal with both. It's true that we're generating a lot of low-wage employment. At the same time, we could have strategies to generate more high-wage, middle-skill employment. both through things that might lift up wages at the bottom of the labor market, like the minimum wage, living wages, etc., but also the kinds of investments to kind of bring manufacturing and industry back into the United States. What prevents us from making those investments that would deal with essentially the kinds of inequality between the 90th percentile and the 10th percentile is the political power of the top 1%. Groups like the Koch brothers, who are investing in things that wind up kind of really freezing us from doing the kind of economic policies that the Economic Policy Institute is generally recommending as ways of generating jobs that would actually be decent paying jobs in the future. So while there's two kinds of inequality in the United States, the top 1% and then the sort of wage inequality for the rest of us, they're connected because the political power of the super wealthy blocks rational strategies for the rest of us.
Valerie, when we talk about this unnaturally high, or maybe it is naturally high, unemployment rate during this period of, quote, post-recession, etc., we very often do not talk about people who are suffering much higher rates of unemployment, sometimes twice the normal level of unemployment, or 1.5 times. Do you want to talk about Black unemployment and Latino unemployment during this period?
So, yeah, what you just described is typically what we see as a race unemployment rate gap. Unfortunately, that 2-to-1 gap for African Americans relative to whites has been persistent throughout history. It's been persistent since the Bureau of Labor Statistics has been collecting data on unemployment rates by race and ethnicity. That 2-to-1 unemployment rate gap is persistent across levels of education. You find that African-American college graduates typically have an unemployment rate that is twice as high as white college graduates, and you see the same thing on down the scale. You also continue to see the gap regardless of gender. We look at Black men and white men, 2-to-1, Black women versus white women, nearly 2-to-1. It's a little better for women. We also see it across aid cohorts. So whether we're looking at older workers or younger workers, we still see this persistent gap. This is an issue that has been a problem in American society for a number of years. There have been any number of attempts to explain why the gap exists, but again, even if we control for factors that we would reasonably expect to affect someone's likelihood of getting a job, things like education, experience, we continue to see a persistent gap. And when we look at Latinos and whites, there's a gap there as well. It's about 1.5 times higher for Latinos relative to whites. And some of the reasons that we see for the gap across groups may vary, but the fact remains that even after controlling for factors that we would expect to affect someone's likelihood of being employed, those gaps continue to exist. And so the ongoing discussion or debate around the issue is how much of this is really discrimination. The 2-to-1 or 1.5 times to 1 unemployment gap is an issue that definitely impacts income inequality, wage inequality along racial lines.
So where is this going to leave us for those of us who are intent on trying to level the playing field and take us into a kind of momentum, give us those policies, that agenda to set our sights on rectifying these dilemmas?
Well, what an easy question.
I've figured, but I'm totally confident that the two of you have
solve all our problems.
The answers, absolutely. We're very confident,
yeah.
And we're desperately seeking.
The first thing I would say is that changing our narrative and frame, that we understand that investing in all of us will move all of us forward. So that this way in which people have been left behind in the labor market is not actually good for the health of the U.S. economy. The over-incarceration of, in particular, African-American men, but Latino men as well, it's, you know, politically, it's economically costly, not only in terms of imprisoning, but also in terms of freezing people out of the labor market. The gender disparities are leaving talent to one side, meaning that an increasing number of households headed by single women are not getting the resources they need to thrive in the future. So first thing we need to do is to really reframe this so people realize what the broad costs are to the general society. The second thing in terms of policy is to understand that we need to lift up the bottom of the labor market. On the other hand, create better paths through the labor market, and three, do a better job of growing the labor market. So on the bottom end of the labor market, we need many more protections for those who are on the bottom. That includes protections against wage theft. That includes increasing the minimum wage, improving the conditions for unionization. It includes comprehensive immigration reform so that undocumented workers can become part of a system in which they have more formal legal rights to defend themselves. In terms of pathways to the labor market, we need many more articulations of community colleges and other job training forces with employers to understand what the employer needs are and to do the training that makes sense. And then, and that's, you know, you do find employers saying that while they can get a lot of low-wage workers, they're not sure they can get the kind of higher-skill workers that they need. And then we need to grow the economy, and that means not being afraid to make those kind of investments in public infrastructure and moving forward that are really critical. Key to doing all of that is breaking the political power of the super rich, because they remain locked in an old economic model that their own privilege is not only important to them, but somehow good for the world. And they remain with a stranglehold over the policy-making processes. We need to change the frame, we need to change the policies, and we need to change the balance of political power.
And Valerie, prescriptions for change?
I think Manuel has accurately articulated a lot of the things that are necessary, both in terms of addressing the issues that would help to lift up those at the bottom. And this in particular relates to a lot of the racial and gender disparities that we see, because we know that minorities and women are disproportionately in lower wage occupations. But I think another thing that I want to build upon, he talked about the political power of the super rich and how that has impacted our economic policy making. The reason why we have not seen the level of job growth that we need to have seen in this recovery has been mainly because there's been inadequate demand. Employers are not going to hire workers unless there is an increased demand for what it is they're producing. The fact that there's been inadequate demand has really stifled job growth, and that's directly related to a lot of the policy focus that has been around austerity as opposed to making the kinds of public investments that will help to grow the economy and increase aggregate demand. At the end of last year, Congress failed to renew unemployment insurance extensions. That is critical to people who are out of work, and it also is a form of economic stimulus. It helps to provide an income support for people who are out of work. And the fact that they would decide not to renew that at a time when long-term unemployment continues to be above 35% is really just unheard of. You know, we saw a lot of the cutting in public investment over the last year. We've seen the government shutdown and that entire fiasco being something that really was a shift away from what needed to be done in the recovery towards more of this political back and forth and this political positioning about whether or not people are putting forth enough effort to find jobs, you know, whether or not people need to do more to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. You know, another thing that we've seen is that instead of job growth in the public sector increasing after the recession, as again we have typically seen coming out of recessions, it's actually declined. So we've actually been doing the opposite of what should be done to stimulate aggregate demand, increase job creation, which would then help to promote the kind of broader economic growth that we want to see. We definitely cannot underestimate or undervalue what political posturing and positioning has done in this recovery to really be detrimental to the country as a whole.
Thoughts about progressive taxation?
What about taxing the banks also?
Definitely. We've seen over the last 20 years or so, our income tax policy, you know, is basically a progressive system, but we've seen that, you know, at the top, people have gotten many more breaks, and it's through the various loopholes in the system, the effective tax rate has been declining for those at the top. So I know one of the recommendations that people have shared for helping to increase federal revenues is to have a financial transactions tax that would help to redistribute some of the income away from those at the very top and help to support investment in the kinds of public investments that will help to grow the broader economy and generate more shared prosperity.
And a financial transactions tax would have the second benefit of reducing financial transactions. We lose a lot of productive potential in banks shifting around money from one asset to another rather than making the kind of long-term investments in companies, ideas, and innovation. That's the kind of policy measure that weds together the concerns around equity and generating economic growth that we need to be thinking about.
And, of course, the idea of strengthening labor laws and organizing to bring people into the organized labor process and supporting all those fast food workers and other movements that have been out there to organize, that's all critical part of what have to be the policy recommendations to really look at the redistribution of wealth and the incredible, the enormity in this gilded age of income and wealth disparity. And I really want to thank both of you. You've been most insightful and educative to us. Valerie Wilson, director of the Economic Policy Institute's Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy, and Manuel Pastor, who has more titles than I can shake a fist at, is the founding director, as I said, of the Center for Justice, Tolerance, and Community at the University of California. And one of your most recent publications, what should we look for to read?
The one I think that's directly relevant to this is a book called Just Growth, Prosperity and Inclusion in America's Metropolitan Regions, in which we argue that many people think that we just need just growth. We'll move things forward. But what we really need is just growth. That is, a growth model that is intentionally focused on equity and uses equity and equity enhancements for the least advantaged amongst us as a way to build economic growth.
Thank you again, both Manuel Pastor and Valerie Wilson.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.